Chapter 35. Max had racked his brain, thinking of a way out of the subterranean fortress, and he had only one solution. On a late-night foray, he had discovered triple guards on the stairwell leading to the garage, and he knew that he wasn't going to bluff his way past them. Kovach had left his face a swollen mess, and the guards would be suspicious the moment they saw him. He wasn't getting out the front door, so he had to sneak out the back. He left his hiding place in the closet of the executive wing and made his way to the generator room. He made sure to hide his face from the few people he passed in the hallways. He rounded a corner nearest the room where the jet engines spun the turbines that powered the facility and saw that Kovach had ordered a guard to stand watch here as well. Keeping his pace steady and measured, he walked down the corridor. The guard, a kid of about 20 wearing a blue police-style uniform and with a nightstick in his belt, eyed him as he approached. "How you doing?" Max called jovially when he was still 10 feet away. "Yeah, I know, my face looks like hamburger. A bunch of anti-abortion zealots jumped me day before yesterday at a rally in Seattle. I just got here. Hell of a place, huh?" "This is a restricted area unless you have a clearance badge." The kid forced authority into his voice by deepening it, but he didn't seem overly wary. "Is that so? Only thing I've been issued so far are these." Max pulled his last two bottled waters from the pockets of his overalls. "Here." Rather than offer it and give the kid an opportunity to refuse, he tossed a bottle to the guard. He caught it awkwardly and glared at Max. Max grinned stupidly and twisted off the cap of his bottle. He held it up in a salute. Etiquette and thirst overcame the young guard's limited security training, and he pried off the lid and returned Max's salute. He raised the bottle to his lips and tipped his head back to take a swig. Max lunged like an Olympic fencer, ramming the stiffened fingers of his right hand directly into the soft spot at the base of the kid's throat. Water spewed from his mouth as his airway swelled closed. He couldn't cough. He managed a gurgling sound as his eyes bugged from his head and he clutched for his throat in a desperate attempt to get air. Max laid the guard out with a haymaker to the side of the jaw, and he fell at his feet. He bent to check on his breathing. Now that the guard was unconscious, he stopped hyperventilating and could draw a little air through his damaged larynx. His voice would be a husky whisper for the rest of his life, but he'd live. "If I were you, I'd ask for a refund from whatever security guard training school you went to." Max opened the door to the generator room. The control room was deserted and, by the looks of the displays, only one of the jet engines was making power. Max stuffed the young guard into the knee hole of a metal desk and manacled his wrists to the leg with his flexicuffs. He didn't need to worry about gagging him. Hanley had already considered the idea of sabotaging the engines and denying the responsivists the means of transmitting the signal, but felt it would be a waste of time. He knew they had a fully charged battery backup in some part of the facility he hadn't seen, so they would still be able to send it. If he managed to find and somehow disable the batteries, all he would accomplish is a short delay until they could repair the damage. He'd maybe buy a few hours or days while giving away his presence. The reason they hadn't found him lurking in their headquarters was because they thought he was either dead or eluding them outside. As soon as they knew a saboteur was inside the bunker, the security contingent would comb it inch by inch until they found him. He could just imagine how painful a death Kovach would have in store for him. Max was certain Cabrillo had gotten the message and trusted without question that the chairman had come up with a plan to destroy the transmitter long before Severance sent the signal. So he discounted the idea of sabotage and had dedicated his time to an escape plan. The four engines were laid out in a row, with fat ducts feeding them air on one end and large exhaust pipes venting the spent gases from the other. Just before the ducts exited the room through the far wall, the four pipes came together in a manifold so that a single large exhaust duct led outside. There was a heat exchanger located just after the pipes came together to cool the gases leaving the facility. The air intake worked the same in reverse, with a single conduit entering the power plant and branching off to the separate turbines. Max would have preferred that route, but the plenums were 10 feet off the floor and inaccessible without a scaffolding. "If it's good enough for Juan, it's good enough for me," he muttered, thinking back to Cabrillo's escape from the Golden Dawn. He found tools and ear protectors on a workbench at the back of the control room and slid open the door to the power plant's main floor. With his ears covered, the engine's whine remained at a tolerable threshold. Before he got to work, he checked a distinctive red cabinet. Without its contents, his escape attempt would kill him. There was an access port on each of the 4 exhaust pipes that was secured with a ring of bolts. He got to work removing the 3-inch-long bolts, taking care that none rolled away from him. He had taken apart his first engine at age 10 and had never lost his love of machinery, so he worked swiftly and efficiently. He left one bolt in place but had loosened it so he could pivot the inspection hatch away from the hole. Although the engine fitted to this exhaust duct was silent, the fumes rising up from the pipe made his eyes swim. He grabbed a handful of short, fat bolts from a drawer of spares in the control room. They were a fraction too small for the threaded holes, but they would more than pass a cursory inspection. When the turbine was fired up, the pressure would blow them out of the hatch like bullets, but that wasn't Max's problem. He replaced the tools back in the control room and checked on the unconscious guard to make sure he was still breathing. The red cabinet contained firefighting gear, axes, heat detectors, and most important, air tanks with masks. Because any fire that broke out in the generator room would most likely be fed by the jet's kerosene fuel, there were also 2 silvery one-piece metallic suits with hoods that would protect wearers from the tremendous heat. Max had noticed all of this on his first foray into the generating room, and the discovery had been the genesis of his escape plan. He cut off one of the suit's hoods and slid into it, pulling the second one over him so that everything but his head was double insulated. There was enough play in the boots for his feet, barely. He carried 2 of the air cylinders to the open access port. His movements were awkward, like a robot from an old science fiction movie. The tanks were fitted with armored hoses that jacked directly into the suit at hip level through a valve. He would have preferred carrying more air, but he wasn't sure if his battered body could heft the extra weight. He shoved the tanks into the duct and climbed in after them. The fit was extremely tight, but once he wriggled his way past the manifold, he would have more than enough room. Lying on his back, he was able to rotate the hatch closed and partially thread one of the bolts he'd removed into its hole to hold it in position. After securing the hood of his outermost suit, he cracked open the air tank and took a breath. It tasted stale and metallic. Max had no idea how far the duct ran before reaching the surface, nor what he would find there once he got there, but he had no choice but to start climbing. Pushing the tanks ahead of him, he squeezed himself forward a couple of inches. The pipe was a black so deep it felt like a presence in there with him, while the roar of the running turbine filled his head with echoes. The pain in his chest wasn't too bad, a background ache to remind him of the beating. It wouldn't last, he knew, and very soon he'd be in real agony. Pain was a distraction, Link had told him, passing on some of his SEAL training. It's your body's way of telling you to stop doing something. Just because your body is sending you a message doesn't mean you have to listen. Pain can be ignored. He scraped over the heat exchanger's fins and moved into the manifold, where all 4 exhausts came together. Even with the protection of the suit, he could feel a blast of heat, as if he were standing at the open door of a glassblower's kiln. It would get much worse once he entered the main duct. The exhaust gases originated 30 feet away and had gone through a cooling device, yet it felt as though he were lying directly at the back of the engine nacelle. The force of the exhaust was like a hurricane. Without the suits and the oxygen, Max would have been poisoned by the carbon monoxide and his body burnt to a crisp. Even with the double thermal protection, sweat erupted from every pore in his body, and it was as though someone was holding a hot iron to his feet. The main duct was nearly 6 feet around and rose at a slight angle. He struggled into the air tank's flame-retardant harness, keeping low so as not to get blown off his feet. As he was gingerly pulling the straps over his shoulders, the foot he had placed atop the spare tank slipped. The stream of hot exhaust took hold of the tank, launching it down the pipe like a bullet from a gun. He could hear it, banging against the side of the conduit over the jet's banshee scream. Max tried to walk, but the pressure against his back was simply too great. Each step was a precarious balancing act that threatened to send him careening down the pipe like the errant air tank. He dropped to his hands and knees and began crawling blindly out of the bunker. The intense heat blistered his knees and hands through the high-tech suit and gloves, and the weight of the tank on his back made it so his ribs felt like shattered glass grinding inside his chest. As he lurched farther up the duct, the earth encasing it bled away a lot of the heat. The force of the exhaust pummeling his backside and legs never diminished, but at least the broken blisters had stopped multiplying. "Pain can be ignored," he repeated, saying each word as he moved a limb. Juan ordered an aerial drone to be launched as soon as the Oregon was within range of Eos Island. George Gomez Adams piloted the UAV from a console behind Cabrillo's seat. Only the chairman and Holly were members of the first watch, the watch Juan always used when steaming into a potentially dangerous situation, and it wasn't as if the replacements were any less competent. He just preferred to have his people with him at a time like this. Eric and Mark and the others could anticipate his orders as if they could read his mind, shaving seconds off reaction times, seconds that could mean the difference between life and death. Eddie was down in the boat garage prepping the Rib, the rigid inflatable boat, with Link and the gun dogs. There was only one dock on Eos, and they suspected it was heavily defended, but it might be their only way onto the island. The real-time video feed from the flying UAV would give them an idea of the defenses they might face. Down in the moon pool, the dive team was prepping the Nomad 1000 in case they needed the larger of their two submersibles and laying out tanks and equipment for a 10-man underwater assault. Weapons crews had gone over every gun on the Oregon, ensuring they were cleaned and the ammo hoppers were full. Damage control reported they were prepped, and Julia was down in medical, if the worst happened and her services were needed. Gomez and his hangar team had pulled double and triple shifts since Kyle Hanley's rescue, trying to get the plucky little Robinson helicopter airworthy again. The chopper jockey wasn't too happy with the results. Without a proper test, under controlled parameters, he couldn't guarantee the bird would fly. All the individual mechanical systems worked. He just couldn't say if they all worked together. The elevator had raised the helo to the main deck, and a technician kept the engine warmed to flight temperature, so it sat on 5-minute standby, but Adams begged Cabrillo to use it as the absolute last resort. Juan glanced at the digital countdown on the main view screen. They had 1 hour and 11 minutes to find Max and get his sorry butt off the island. In truth, they had less than that, because when the orbital ballistic projectile slammed into Eos, there was a good chance it would spawn a massive wave. Eric's calculations said that it would stay localized, and the topography of the sparsely populated Gulf of Mandalay would severely dampen its effect, but any ship within 20 miles of Eos was in for a wild ride. The Oregon was 15 miles from the island when its image from the UAV slowly resolved on the main monitor like a gray lump on the otherwise brilliant seas that gave this part of Turkey the nickname Turquoise Coast. George flew the drone over the 8-mile-long island at 3,000 feet, high enough so its engine couldn't be heard, and with the sun beginning a rapid slide into the west, it would be near impossible to see. Eos was nothing but barren rock and the occasional scrub pine. He focused the UAV's camera on where the responsivists had built their bunker, but there was nothing to see. Any entrance remained well camouflaged from this altitude. The only way to know it was even there was the paved road that terminated at the base of a low hillock. "Holly, capture a couple stills off the feed and enhance them," Juan ordered. "See if you can find any doors or gates at the head of the road."
"I'm on it."
"Okay, George, swing us around. I want to check out the beach and dock." Using his joystick, Adams banked the remote-controlled plane back over the sea so he could approach the dock from out of the sun. The beach stretched for only a few hundred feet, and rather than soft white sand, it was composed of water-worn rock chips. Sheer cliffs rose more than 100 feet on either side of the beach, hemming it in completely. The cliffs themselves appeared unassailable without climbing equipment and a few hours. The dock was situated at the exact center of the beach, an L-shaped jetty that thrust into the water a good 80 feet before the seafloor fell away, enough for the small freighters that had brought the equipment to build the facility. The causeway looked sturdy and was more than wide enough for the excavators and cement mixers that had once swarmed the island. A corrugated metal building sat where the jetty met the road. A parapet wrapped around the flat roof, giving a wide open field of fire for anyone up there. They also had an unobstructed view of the sea approaches. A pickup truck was parked behind the guardhouse. They could see two guards with high-powered binoculars on the roof, automatic weapons at their sides. Another pair of guards was walking the jetty, while two more patrolled the beach. Any communication lines they had with the main facility were buried, so there was no way to knock them out in order to isolate the guardhouse. Juan imagined Zelimir Kovac had laid out the security, and he would have left standing orders that, at the first sign of anything suspicious, the bunker was to be notified so it could go on immediate lockdown. "Switch to thermal imaging," he said. The scene on the monitor changed so that nearly every detail dropped out, except for the body heat given off by the guards. There were teams of two atop each cliff they hadn't noticed on the visual scan. "What do you make of those trace signals next to the guys on the cliffs?" George asked. "Small engines cooling down. Most likely ATVs similar to the ones they had in Corinth. Heck of a lot of fun to ride, provided no one's shooting at you." Cabrillo was more interested in the signal emanating from the road. It was waste heat from their power plant, just as Eric had said. They had done an excellent job of masking the heat signature. To even the most trained observer, it looked like the road was merely radiating heat built up during the day. The dull orange line on the thermal scan continued out along the jetty before spreading nearly the width of the dock. It had to be a diffuser, he thought, to further mask their heat signature. He saw no sign of the air intake manifolds. Cabrillo hit an intercom button so he could speak to Eddie and Link, who had been watching the aerial reconnaissance on a monitor in the boat garage. "What do you think?" He knew the answer before Eddie replied. "We're going to pay a hell of a butcher bill, and there are no guarantees. Have you gotten any detailed shots of where the road ends?" "Holly's working on it now." "They're coming up on screen," Kasim said. The enhanced stills flashed onto the monitor, and everyone eyed them carefully. The road simply stopped at the hill. They knew there had to be doors to allow entrance, but they were too well hidden. "Depending how armored they are, we might be able to blast our way in," Eddie offered with little enthusiasm. "We don't know if it'll take a couple of ounces of C4 or a cruise missile." "Then we use the Nomad to get us in close to shore and try to find the air intakes. We'll need a torch to cut our way out of the pipe once we get inside," Eddie said. "I just wish we had more time to let the sun go down." The orbital track of the Russian satellite had dictated the time of their assault, and there was nothing anyone could do about it. Juan looked at the clock again just as the hour display clicked to zero. "What are those two guards on the dock doing?" George asked, after flipping the drone's cameras back to visual.
"Laying down on the job, it looks like," Juan remarked absently.
"I think there might be something in the water. I'm going to swing the UAV around for a better view." Without light, Max had no way to determine how much air remained in the tank, but he estimated he had been crawling for 20 minutes. As much as he had tried to keep his breathing as shallow as possible, he knew he was using up the precious air at a prodigious clip, and there was no end in sight. The tunnel ahead was as inky as the length stretching out behind him. Another 10 minutes and he could feel it growing more difficult to breathe. The tank was approaching empty. Soon he would be breathing the last of the air trapped in his suit, and then he would begin to suffocate. Spending so much of his life at sea, Max had always thought he'd die drowning. He had just never considered drowning in a vortex of noxious jet exhaust. Doggedly, he plodded on, gaining a foot with each four-legged pace. The outer suit was a charred ruin, and pieces of it were tearing away, especially at the knee. Fortunately, the single layer of protection remaining was more than ample.
"Kyle will be okay," he thought.
He was certain that no matter what, Juan would rescue his son again. And because of the fiasco the first time, he would use a different shrink to help deprogram his mind. The chairman never made the same mistake twice, even if he didn't know what had caused it in the first place. Max even believed that he would figure out that it was Dr. Jenner who had betrayed them, though he knew Juan would never guess Jenner's true identity. He could hardly believe it himself.
"Dying to rescue a child," he mused.
He couldn't think of a single greater cause to die for. He hoped someday Kyle would come to recognize the sacrifice, and he prayed his daughter would forgive her brother for their father's death.
Pain can be ignored.
It felt as though he were climbing Everest. He needed to breathe as deeply as possible to suck in enough air, but each time he did, his ribs screamed. And no matter how deeply he inhaled or how much he ached, his lungs never felt full. His hand smacked something in the darkness. His engineer's sensibilities were instantly insulted. An exhaust shaft like this should be completely clear of obstructions in order to get peak efficiency out of the turbines. He felt around the object and gave a giddy laugh. It was the spare air tank that had been sent tumbling down the duct. In its mad flight up the exhaust vent, it had finally come to rest with its more aerodynamic top facing into the flow. Max hurriedly unplugged his nearly depleted tank and jacked in the fresh one. The air was just as stale and metallic, but he could care less. 15 minutes later, he saw the proverbial light at the end of the tunnel. The duct widened and flattened into a diffuser to help mask the hot exhaust from thermal imaging. The stealth bomber and fighter used something similar. The pressure of hot exhaust diminished when he removed his tank and got on his belly to crawl into the diffuser. There were thin vertical bars over its mouth to prevent someone from entering the duct. He could see the ocean surging about 8 feet below him. It had to be high tide. Otherwise, water would pour down the exhaust duct when it came in. He imagined the vent had a cover that could be lowered in the event of a storm. Forcing the bulky helmet through the vertical bars proved impossible, so he had no idea what lay to the right or left of his position. He would just have to rely on luck. He spun around so that he could ram one of the bars with the air tank. Lying on his side, he couldn't get that much momentum, so he pushed himself back a bit and tried again. He could feel the impact through his hands as he hit the grill again and again. Weakened by the combined effects of salt air and corrosive exhaust, a weld on one of the vertical bars snapped with the fifth blow. He repeated his assault on a second bar and then a third. Satisfied he had enough room to squeeze through, he gripped each thin metal bar and bent it outward. He poked his head outside. There was a narrow platform immediately below the diffuser and a ladder to his right that led upward. He was just turning to look to the left when he was grabbed by the shoulders and yanked out of the exhaust shaft. It happened so fast he had no time to react before he was thrown onto a dock. Two guards stood over him, each with a submachine gun slung under his arm. Unlike the kid Max had knocked unconscious back in the generator room, these two had the look of professionals.
And just what you think you're doing, mate?
The guard spoke with a thick Cockney accent. With the helmet on and his ears ringing from so much time spent in the duct, Max saw the guard's lips moving but couldn't hear the words. As soon as he moved to pull his helmet off, their fingers tightened on the triggers. One guard stepped back to cover his partner, who tore the helmet away.
"Who are you?" he demanded.
"Hiya, fellas. I'm Dusty Pipes from the Acme Chimney Sweep Company."